Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
You're listening to Campus Killings, brought to you by Abject Entertainment. Be sure to check out some of the other great true crime podcasts from this network, including The Murder in My Family,
DNA ID, Zodiac Speaking,
Scene of the Crime, Missing Persons,
Beyond Bizarre True Crime,
and Citizen Detective. All of these podcasts are available for you to binge on right now, wherever you listen to podcasts. Subscribe where you're listening to this podcast so you don't miss an episode.
Today's case takes us to Bend, Oregon, and the Central Oregon Community College. I want to give a special thank you to our listener, Catherine, for alerting us to this one. In her email to us, she says that this case is a, quote, wild story. And I have to tell you, Megan, as I was researching this, there's really no other way to describe it. Now, this case was heavily covered in a lot of Oregon's local news, but I don't think it made national headlines, so I'm glad that Catherine brought this story to our attention. As we'll see through the episode, it's chilling to follow how the decisions of one man can send shockwaves through not just a community, but a whole state. But before we get into that, let's take a look at the school. Founded in 1949, Central Oregon Community College, or COCC, is the oldest operating two-year institution in Oregon. Located on the west side of Bend, the main campus sits on the edge of Deschutes National Forest, and it offers spectacular views of the Oregon Cascade Mountain Range, as well as multiple hiking trails and outdoor recreation activities. The over 200-acre campus is quite large and is described as offering quiet, peaceful surroundings for study and reflection. COCC also has three satellite campuses throughout Oregon. And being so close to national forests and covering so much ground, COCC needed quite a bit of campus security to keep their students safe. But for one security guard, a 30-year-old alumni of COCC named Edwin Lara, student safety was the last thing on his mind. So who is Edwin Lara? While there isn't much published about his childhood, we do know that Edwin emigrated to the U.S. with his mother from Honduras when he was in elementary school. His parents divorced when he was young, and his mother remarried. It's not clear if she remarried after immigrating or before, but basically Edwin grew up with his mother, a stepfather, and a few siblings. By his mother's account, Edwin was a good child. He was quiet and soft-spoken, loving towards his family, and while he did get into some issues with drugs and drinking in high school, he didn't seem to have any contact with law enforcement or behavior problems at home. So, Megan, I would assume that these drug alcohol issues may have just been normal teenage behaviors, because nothing I could find suggested that he had a drug or drinking problem as an adult or got into any trouble for it as a teenager.
Okay.
The only record I could find for Edwin was several traffic tickets and a fish and game citation, which is essentially fishing without a license.
Right. And a very minor infraction.
While Edwin's parents initially settled in California when he was young, by the time he was high school age, they moved him to Madras, Oregon, where Edwin attended Madras High School and then went to get his associate's degree at COCC. And this is where he majored in criminal justice. After graduating, Edwin went on to get his bachelor's in criminal justice as he hoped to be a police officer one day. Edwin and his family attended a local church, and that is where he met and later married a woman named Isabel Pons. The two bought a home in Redmond that was not far away from Edwin's parents. Isabel also had dreams of becoming a police officer, and she and Edwin remained very involved in their church, so the two seemed to have a lot in common. And in 2015 and 2016, their collective dreams of law enforcement career seemed to materialize. This is when Isabel was hired with the Bend Police Department, and was in training to be a patrol officer. And Edwin took a job at his alma mater, COCC, as a part-time security officer patrolling the campus. However, it would soon come to light that not all was as perfect as it seemed to be on the surface. You see, while Isabel was at the police academy prior to starting on the Bend Police Force, Edwin had an affair with a woman from California. Isabel would later speculate that it was because Edwin was jealous that she had gotten a job as a, quote, real police officer, and he was only a security guard at a community college. For those listeners who may not know, oftentimes a police officer is hired by a department and then sent to police academy for training before returning to the department. In other words, the department will pay for the training. And this is what was happening in Isabel's situation. Also, some of these police academies are what you would call sleepaway academies. So the officer would be gone for 4 to 6 months, depending on the program. Now, while Edwin was upfront with Isabel about the affair when she returned home from the police academy, it obviously put a serious strain on their marriage. The two stopped attending church. They were very cold with each other, and though Edwin claimed he'd ended the affair, Isabel no longer trusted him. In addition to this, Edwin's colleagues at COCC security office had noticed that Edwin was exhibiting some bizarre behaviors in the winter of 2016. Now, this would have been while Isabel was at the police academy. During this time, he had gone on vacation to Honduras to visit some family, and while he was there, he sent his colleagues a video of a dead human body that he had found in a field.
What?
He also told colleagues that he'd been a police officer in Honduras at some point, and he had seen bodies, quote, all chopped up. But Megan, this could not have been true, as Edwin had been in the U.S. since he had been around 7 years old, and he had never returned to Honduras for more than a few weeks' vacation. So now we see bizarre behavior, lying.
That we've never previously really observed from what we know.
Exactly.
Okay.
He also showed several colleagues pornographic videos and photos that he'd taken of him and the woman that he was having an affair with. According to one of Edwin's female colleagues in the security office, she was so alarmed by his behaviors that she decided that she would no longer ride in a patrol car with him.
Yeah, I don't blame her. I'm sorry. Did you say that he sent pornographic pictures to his colleagues?
Yes.
This is very fireable, I would think, but okay.
Yeah, so he showed them. He didn't send them. So I don't know. Maybe there wasn't proof of it. I don't know. But yes.
If not proof, but otherwise, a report of this would certainly subject him to being fired. But anyway,
I agree. The problem is it's unclear if these incidents were reported to the administration at COCC. But as far as I could find, Edwin was never brought up on charges or reprimanded for these behaviors. I did look to see what kind of background checks COCC required for public safety, and I couldn't find anything specific. There was one article that said background checks of their security guards were not as thorough as those of Bend police officers. So I assume that Edwin had some level of background check, but probably no psych eval or polygraph. And in other words, probably nothing that would have caught any mental health issues that he was experiencing.
And with no criminal history, that kind of makes sense. Okay. Yeah.
And unfortunately for several victims, Edwin's bizarre behavior would quickly turn deadly.
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Only a short distance from COCC's campus was an apartment complex where many young 20-somethings lived. The complex was not owned by the campus, but many of the students lived there. One of these people was 23-year-old Kaylee Sawyer. Born and raised in Bend, Kaylee was the first and only female child of a large blended family. Her parents had divorced when she was quite young, but they both remarried and went on to have children with their new spouses. So Kaylee was kind of the oldest sibling of this enormous family. And by all accounts, her mother and father got along very well and lived near each other. So Kaylee grew up seeing both sets of parents equally. She was also very close with her four younger brothers. She had two on each side. She spent a lot of time helping them with their homework and supporting them at their sporting events. She was also a very creative person who loved drawing, writing poetry, and taking artistic photography. While Kaylee had always told her family she wanted to become a doctor, after getting a job as a dental hygienist, she fell in love with the profession and realized that becoming a dentist was her real calling. That same year, in pursuit of this dream, she began taking classes at COCC to begin her dental degree. Described by those who loved her as personable and outgoing, Kaylee had many good friends as well as a serious boyfriend named Cameron Reimhofer, and the two lived together. Now, by all accounts, they had a very good relationship. They had been together for several years. And though Kaylee was known to have walked away from an argument here and there, she would always come back to Cameron and they were able to work out whatever issues they were having. That is until the night of July 22nd, 2016. On this night, Kaylee had gone out to celebrate her best friend's bachelorette party in downtown Bend. The women had been bar hopping, and at their last bar, Kaylee was quite drunk and began intimately dancing with a young male stranger out on the dance floor. According to her friends, there were some kissing involved as well, and they were quick to pull her off the dance floor to check her behavior. Kaylee agreed that she had gotten too drunk and had made some questionable choices, and she decided it was best if she went home, so she called Cameron to come pick her up. Cameron arrived at the bar around midnight to drive Kaylee back to their apartment, which was about 20 minutes away. Now, we don't know exactly what was said on this drive, but it is known that the two got into an argument, presumably about the kissing and the dancing, at the bar. By the time they arrived at the apartment complex, Kaylee was mad enough that she didn't want to get out of the car. Cameron would later say that he wasn't put off by this, as Kaylee often needed time to cool off if they were having a fight. So he told Kaylee to come up to their apartment when she was ready, and he left her in the car as he went up to the apartment. Now, normally, Kaylee only took 10 to 20 minutes to cool down, so Cameron became a little worried when around a half an hour had passed and Kaylee had still not come inside. And when Cameron went out to the parking lot, he found that Kaylee was no longer in the car where he had left her, nor was she anywhere to be seen. Cameron texted her to find out where she was, to which she replied that she was still mad and she was out walking on the road.
That's really concerning. Okay.
He then texted her that he was sorry and to come back to the apartment so they could work it out. But she replied, "My phone is dying. Goodbye." And then Cameron's text to her went unanswered. Cameron waited up for most of the night, texting and calling his girlfriend, but Kaylee never came home and never answered her phone again. By around 8 a.m. the next morning, Cameron was distraught and called Kaylee's parents and her best friend to see if perhaps Kaylee had gone to any of their homes to spend the night. But unfortunately, Kaylee was not at their houses either. So Cameron called 911 around 9 a.m. on July 22nd to report Kaylee missing. And I'm happy to report, because we don't see this in all cases, that the Bend Police Department took immediate action in looking for Kaylee. They started tracking her phone via cell tower pings, and though they did get a ping, it was for an old cell phone that she had gifted to another friend, not the cell phone she had been using that evening. Kaylee's photo was posted everywhere around Bend, and her family and friends spent the next several days doing group searches of the surrounding woods, while police alerted surrounding precincts and dove deeper into phone records and got warrants to see if they could track any of her credit and debit card use. But after 3 days, there was still no sign of Kaylee. However, police were able to get a huge break in the case, and one from inside their own precinct. On July 25th, 4 days after Kaylee disappeared, Officer Isabel Lara came to the Bend Police Department on her day off to report a crime. You see, that very morning, her husband, Edwin Lara, had confessed to her that he had killed a young woman. In her subsequent interview with her own colleagues, Isabel explained that Edwin had woken up that morning and had been very withdrawn, which she had attributed to their ongoing marital problems. But as he sat down on the couch next to her, he began to weep and said that he hit a woman with his car while on patrol at COCC and he had killed her. He claimed that he had panicked and he hit the woman and hit her body. When Isabel urged him to report the crime, Edwin stole Isabel's gun and fled the home, driving away in Isabel's personal car.
Wow.
Recall, Isabel was a police officer, so she had a firearm.
And why do I have a feeling that he didn't actually hit her with his car? That's not the full story.
But yeah, okay. Well, we'll find out. The evidence, in fact, does not match that story. But
okay.
The problem is Edwin turned off his phone and she was not able to locate him. She had no idea where he fled to, But Isabel told her colleagues that he was armed and he was really scared, which meant that he was probably very dangerous.
Right.
She also compiled a search of her house and property to see if Edwin had left any clues about where he had gone. But what investigators turned up was more than a clue. You see, in the garden shed behind the house, detectives located Kaylee's green purse that she had had with her the night she disappeared. And all of her belongings were still inside, including her passport that she had been using as an ID at the bars and her wallet. And the purse was drenched in blood. Detectives also discovered a blood-covered boulder with a large clump of bloody blonde hair stuck to it that had been wrapped in white plastic bags. Stuffed inside an old tire, Edwin's COCC security uniform was also located, and it too was covered in blood. Later DNA tests would reveal that the blood and hair did in fact belong to Kaylee. In follow-up interviews with Isabel and Kaylee's family, it was confirmed that Edwin Lara did not know Kaylee Sawyer, so without any known motive and no history of violence, police needed to find Edwin. They needed to get his side of the story to find out what happened to Kaylee and where her body was. But nothing could have prepared the state of Oregon for what Edwin Lara would do next.
We'll return after a brief word from our sponsors.
After fleeing his home, Edwin drove to his parents' house. Here he would leave Isabel's car in their driveway, and he stole his mother's car. I would assume he thought the police would maybe know what car was his car, so he wanted to maybe hide. Or maybe he just isn't thinking clearly at this point.
Probably trying to hide, but it won't be that long before they figure that out either.
Nope. Edwin drove northeast in his mother's station wagon, and the station wagon began to have issues as he approached a mall on the outskirts of a town called Salem. Unbeknownst to 19-year-old Andrea Mays, who had just finished her shift at the Ross Dress for Less and had gone out to her car to get a bag of clothes, Edwin was scoping out the parking lot for a carjacking. He watched Andrea grab her clothing from the car, go into the store, and then return to her car and sit in it while she was on her phone. Her window was half open in the car. In her interview with KGW8's podcast, Urge to Kill, Andrea describes how she was reading a Facebook message as she sat in her car when all of a sudden an arm shot through her window. This is my biggest fear. Anytime I'm just sitting in my car looking at my phone, I think about, like, what if someone just approaches me right now? It's so frightening. Now, at first, Andrea thought this was just a coworker playing a prank, as probably many of us would, because you couldn't imagine what else it would be.
Right.
But then she quickly registered what was happening. She realized that the arm belonged to a strange man and he had a gun in his hand, and he was ordering her to unlock her door. She did so, and he got in and told her to drive. She recalled to KGW8 that, quote, "I was hyperventilating. I just started driving. In my head, I was like, just take him where he needs to go and he'll let you go. Maybe just to the end of the street." But Megan, as they drove, the man told her he wanted her to take him to California. And just for some geography, we're talking about a 4-hour drive from Salem to get to the border of California. Andrea was understandably petrified, but she had no choice but to do what the armed man wanted her to do. She drove for over an hour before he told her to pull over because she was speeding and he didn't want to attract the cops. At this point, he took a pair of handcuffs out of his backpack and he handcuffed her to the gear shift and told her to move to the passenger seat. He then took over driving as they headed towards California. As Andrea sat in a state of shock and terror, the stranger introduced himself as Edwin Lara and began making small talk, like he had, almost as if he hadn't just kidnapped her, like they were just two friends chatting.
Which seems odd, but I've heard of other cases where this happens.
Yep. And he gives his real name.
It's not necessarily a bad thing, though. It seems very odd, but it's not necessarily a bad thing if she can become friendly with him and he sees her as a person.
And as you might have guessed, she did in fact survive because she did later talk to news stations. So, perhaps this did work out to her benefit. But at first she refused to talk to him. So she says he just began talking about himself. And about 2 hours into the drive, Andrea recalled that he started showing her pictures of his wife. And he said, quote, "Oh, I'm a cop. I don't know if you heard what happened to the girl I just killed." Ugh. Edwin then showed Andrea a news article on his phone, but she had no idea who Kaylee Sawyer was or what Edwin was even talking about. She recalled just trying to stay as calm as possible because she knew that Edwin was dangerous and she didn't want to do anything that would provoke him. Mm-hmm. Edwin drove into California around 11:30 p.m. and he was tired, so he decided it was time for them to find a motel to spend the night. He told Andrea that if she even made eye contact with anyone at the motel, he would kill her and whoever she was looking at. So she kept her eyes averted as Edwin paid for a room. Once in the room, he handcuffed her to the bathroom door while he showered, and then he moved her to the bed and handcuffed her to the bed frame. He then forced her to take sleeping pills that he had, and though she did ingest them, she tried very hard to stay awake for fear of what he would do if she did actually fall asleep.
Sure.
And her fears were warranted, since as soon as she'd taken the sleeping pill, Edwin laid in the bed next to her and began trying to touch her. However, Andrea was able to convince Edwin that she had a very bad STD and he left her alone and made a phone call instead. She's a very smart girl.
Yeah. I wonder, do we know who he called?
Well, she wasn't able to make out what he said, but he did become panicked and began throwing things into a backpack. So maybe he spoke to somebody who said that the police were looking for him. I'm not sure, and it's not written in public records.
Okay.
He pulled Andrea off the bed, saying that they needed to get back in the car and drive. Though she tried to convince him to just take the car and leave her at the motel, he insisted that she had to come with him because the police would not shoot him if he had her. He then forced her into the passenger seat and they drove off. But about 2 hours into the second trip, Andrea's car began to leak oil. Around 5 a.m. on July 26, Edwin pulled into another motel in Eureka, California, and told Andrea that they were going to steal a new car. Andrea again begged him to just leave her at the motel and go on his own. But again, he refused to let her go, and he scoped out a man who had left his motel room door open as he loaded equipment into his truck. Andrea recalled Edwin dragging her into the man's room and demanding the keys to the man's vehicle or he would kill him. The man yelled for help and Edwin shot him in the stomach.
Ooh.
Now, luckily, the man did survive because help came almost immediately, but unfortunately not fast enough to actually catch Edwin as he was already carjacking his next victim by the time the ambulance showed up. Now, this is just to show you how fast Edwin was moving.
They're also closing in on him, though.
Oh, for sure. Andrea recalled almost blacking out at the sound of the gunshot and only really coming to when she realized that Edwin was forcing her to run to a gas station across the street from the motel. As Andrea tried to fight off the effects of the sleeping pill and her trauma after the shooting, Edwin carjacked a minivan that was gassing up at one of the pumps. Now inside this car was a 17-year-old boy, his grandmother, and his younger brother. The boy's father was inside the Quickie Mart paying for the gas. Edwin forced his way into the van and ordered the 17-year-old to drive. The boy, Nima, who also spoke with KGW8, told journalists that Edwin, quote, proceeded to ask us if we've ever had the urge to kill. He then said, well, I used to be a good guy. I used to be a cop. And then I had an urge to kill, so I ran over this girl. Now, Nima was smart as well because he tried to appeal to Edwin's good guy and begged him to let the family out of the van since Nima's grandmother was old and having a panic attack in the back seat. Mm. And Megan, this worked because Edwin told Nima to pull over just 15 minutes later.
And he let the entire family go?
He did. He let the entire family go, and Andrea once again begged Edwin to also let her go, but he told her he needed her to be his human shield so that the cops wouldn't kill him if they were stopped. So yeah, he just left these two boys and their grandmother on the side of the highway and drove off in the van with Andrea. Now, at this point, she had been kidnapped for over 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
As they drove down I-5 through California, Edwin grabbed Andrea's phone out of her pocket and opened her Facebook. He recorded a video introducing himself to her followers, panning the phone to show that Andrea was unharmed in the front seat, and then went on to say, quote, likely I am going to get caught. Sorry about that girl in Central Oregon. She just kept screaming and I had to silence her forever. He told Andrea to share it and hashtag it murderer on the loose, but she was horrified that anyone she knew would see what was happening to her, so she changed the privacy setting so none of her followers would actually see this post.
Really?
You would think maybe she would want them to, right?
Well, that's what I had thought, just maybe because the more people who knew, maybe the easier to find
Her.
Yeah,
I think she was worried that it would alarm everyone. And maybe at this point, like, she thought she was going to get out of this alive. I'm not sure. But, you know, she didn't want her followers to see that what was going on.
Got it.
Next, Edwin used her phone to call his wife, Isabel. And Andrea could hear Isabel urging Edwin to turn himself in. It's unclear exactly what Isabel said to him that made him do what comes next. But as he drove over 100 miles per hour on I-5, Edwin once again used Andrea's phone, but this time he called 911 to admit that he had killed Kaylee Sawyer and that he was ready to talk to the police.
Oh, that's a good sign.
Right? You're not going to believe this next part.
Okay.
So Andrea thought she had been saved as police rushed to the car to arrest Edwin. But Andrea found herself also being arrested by California Police Department as a possible accomplice.
Oh, gosh, stop. They really thought that. Okay.
So she was thrown in a police car and driven to the county jail where she was strip searched, fingerprinted, and mugshots taken. And she was placed in a cell for several hours before she was allowed to see a detective for questioning.
I just cannot believe that.
You know, I was shocked by this as well, but perhaps it was California... maybe it was their police department specific protocol, or maybe someone just really messed up here. I have heard that, you know, I've spoken to people in New Jersey, and by the standards here, maybe she could have been held for questioning, but she would not have been sent to jail to wait.
Or strip searched?
Or strip searched, yeah. So not only was this a horrific ordeal on a poor young woman who had already endured being kidnapped, drugged, and threatened over the past 12 hours, her mugshot was released to the public.
That's terrible. That is so... The re-victimization here is... Mm-hmm. This is just awful. Yep. Okay.
By this point, the Bend, Oregon police were involved, and they explained that Edwin had no accomplice, and whoever he had in the car was not part of the murder. Andrea was then released back to her family the following morning with apologies from the California Police Department. But again, I can't imagine how much trauma this added to her experiences. And I'm not sure if there was any civil suit or anything or any compensation for what had happened to her.
And now, a brief word from our sponsors.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
So after the Bend detectives were able to get Andrea back to her family, they then set to the task to seeing if Edwin would talk to them. Knowing that Edwin had gone to school for criminal justice and that he was a security officer, they assumed that he would ask for a lawyer right away. So they were shocked when he actually did not ask for a lawyer. And they were pretty happy about this, as they hoped that Edwin would give up where he had hidden Kaylee, because they still don't have Kaylee's body.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And while they knew it was a long shot, there was still a shred of hope that maybe, you know, she wasn't dead. Maybe they would find Kaylee alive. To their surprise, Megan, in exchange for a speedy extradition, Edwin easily gave up the information on what he had done with Kaylee, even drawing a map for the police to send back to Bend. While Bend officers immediately started searching for Kaylee using Edwin's map, lead investigator Sergeant Beckwith asked Edwin questions to unravel what had really happened on July 22nd. To start, Edwin stuck with the story that he told Isabel, claiming that he was patrolling the COCC campus and he accidentally hit a woman with his patrol car. He claimed, quote, "I didn't even see her. She was wearing all black." Though he insisted he didn't hit her hard, he just bumped her with the front rack and she fell down.
Okay, I'm assuming this story is going to fall apart quickly.
But it sure will.
Okay.
He says he got out of the car and he could tell that she was very, very drunk. But when she looked up at him, he claimed that she just started screaming. He then says to shut her up, he choked her. But with the evidence found back in his shed, the story didn't match the level of blood or the boulder that was found with blood. Sergeant Beckwith pressed Edwin for more details and he completely changed his story. In his new version, Edwin claimed he never hit anyone with his patrol car. He said he saw a blonde woman walking up the road, and he thought that she was, quote, a prostitute, so he asked her if she wanted a ride, saying, quote, I think she kind of trusted me because of my position. And again, this is referring to the fact that he was in a patrol car and he was wearing a uniform.
Mm-hmm.
He says he then put her in the back of the patrol car, and he claimed that when he asked if she was a hooker, she started screaming at him. Detectives still didn't believe he was telling the truth, and they switched tactics to appeal to his religious beliefs. They encouraged him to tell the truth because God would want him to, and God offered forgiveness for anything he had done. And Megan, this tactic worked. So here was his full confession. Now, Edwin explained to Sergeant Beckwith that he had an urge to kill that he could no longer control. And he claimed he'd had this urge for a long time, that he'd wanted to kill an uncle of an ex-girlfriend at one point, as well as some other people, but he had worked to cover up the urges. And he said most of these urges had gone away after he got married, but they had recently come back and were stronger than ever. And when he saw Kaylee walking alone, he knew that she would trust the fact that he was a campus security officer. So he approached her and offered her a ride home. She then went into the back of the police car, and he took her purse so that she couldn't call 911. Now, trapped in the back of the car, Kaylee began screaming to be let out. Edwin says he needed her to stop screaming, so he got out of the car, opened the back passenger door, and overpowered Kaylee, choking her until she was unconscious. He says he then drove up to COCC's most remote parking lot at the very top of the campus where there weren't any buildings. But then Kaylee woke up on the drive, screaming and shoving her arms through the cage to try to toggle the switches for the lights and sirens on the vehicle. Edwin says he then pulled over and choked Kaylee again until she was unconscious a second time. But this time he took no chances. He pulled her limp body out of the vehicle, grabbed a large rock from the side of the trailhead, and beat her over the head with it until he thought she was dead. He says he then proceeded to rape her and was shocked when she was not dead. She was still breathing and trying to push him off of her. This is when he says he dragged her behind a tree and bludgeoned her with a small boulder until she stopped breathing. When he was certain she was dead, he says he left her there, finishing his shift before changing into street clothes and getting into his personal car. He then drove back up to the murder spot, wrapped Kaylee's head in a plastic bag so it wouldn't bleed everywhere, and threw her body in his trunk. On his way home, he says he dropped Kaylee's body into a ditch off the side of the highway.
Yeah, this was more in line with what I thought he had actually done to her, sadly.
And luckily, although there's nothing lucky here, but at least the family would have some closure because they were able to locate Kaylee's body exactly where Edwin said it would be. And her autopsy results concluded that she had been killed via blunt force trauma to her head. And her wounds were all consistent with Edwin's final confession. And so he was charged with murder, kidnapping, and carjacking before he was extradited back to Oregon. Now, the prosecution felt that they had a slam dunk case going into trial prep. They had a recorded confession by Edwin, and this was all on top of the mountain of forensic evidence. Megan, they hit a huge roadblock almost immediately. You see, when he'd been lodged in the California jail, Edwin asked the staff if he should call a lawyer. Because they thought he was asking a procedural question and not exercising his right to request a lawyer, his request was ignored. Likewise, by California Penal Code, Edwin was supposed to be allowed to make 3 phone calls within 3 hours of being booked. However, he was only allowed access to make 1 phone call to his wife, Isabel, after being booked for over 5 hours. So, technically, Edwin had confessed to the police while he was also being denied a lawyer, which was a violation of his legal rights.
So, they're asking to toss the confession, then.
And they did. The Oregon court threw out his confession, and they would not permit it to be used for trial.
Whoa.
I mean, luckily, there was still a mountain of evidence, not to mention the surveillance footage of Andrea's kidnapping and the carjackings. So,
sure.
You know, throwing out the confession was not going to save Edwin.
Good.
And Oregon still has the death penalty, so Edwin wasn't just facing down the possibility of life in prison. He was facing a death sentence. Ultimately, about 9 months into the trial proceedings, in January of 2018, Edwin and his defense team reached an agreement on a plea deal which downgraded his charges to 1 count of aggravated murder and 1 count of robbery, for which he was sentenced to life without parole.
Well, I'm glad to hear that they struck a deal that would be life in prison. But what about Andrea? What happened to her, this poor girl?
So in 2009, Edwin Lara went back to court to be sentenced for the kidnapping of Andrea Mays. And Edwin's defense team tried to mitigate the sentence by telling the court that while incarcerated, Edwin had been diagnosed with an illness that is a degenerative cognitive brain condition that causes the inability to relax muscles at will and can lead to learning disabilities and impaired cognitive functions. So they believed that since Edwin had no prior criminal record prior to his crime spree, that maybe this condition was what caused his criminal behaviors. This medical claim did not cause the judge to have any compassion on Edwin, who was handed a second life sentence to be served concurrently with his current incarceration. And you had asked about Andrea, and she attended the sentencing, reading her victim impact statement in front of a packed courtroom. And mm-hmm. she spoke directly at Edwin, saying, quote, "I am a survivor. I did conquer you and I defeated you. I'm moving past this and moving on with my life. My mom raised me to be this beautiful, strong, confident person, and I feel a part of that was taken from me when all of this happened. Now I'm starting to refine myself and regain that person again." So what happens after the worst has occurred? Well, Andrea Mays did indeed refine herself, and as of 2020, she was happily working at a T-Mobile call center, as well as running her own line of cosmetic lash extensions called Coconut Cutie Lashes. Actually, our listeners can find that on Instagram if they're interested in supporting her small business.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Not long after Edwin's capture, his wife Isabel filed for divorce, and she also quit her job as a Bend police officer. She would go on to change her last name from Lara back to her maiden name of Ponce. And from what I could find, she now resides in Portland, Oregon, and has no desire to speak to the media about Edwin. And I don't blame her. I mean, her whole livelihood was destroyed because of this
man.
She's
a serious victim here as well. And mm-hmm. I hope that she's had a road to recovery too.
Kaylee Sawyer's family began a charity in her name. Kaylee was an avid reader as a child, and her family created KK's Readers, which donates Dr. Seuss books to Head Start preschool programs throughout Oregon. If our listeners would like to know more about KK's Readers, you can check out their website at kksreaders.org. The Sawyer family also saw larger policy changes in regards to campus safety. Their bill, Kaylee's Law, mandates a stricter background check for private security officers, as well as mandates that security uniforms do not resemble police uniforms, and that campus safety vehicles must all be equipped with GPS and video devices and not be allowed to have blue and red light bars or indoor cages.
Okay.
I'm happy to report that in 2019, the Oregon governor signed Kaylee's Law as Senate Bill 576, making it an official state law.
Oh, I had never heard of it before either. So, okay, thank you.
I think those are really good policy suggestions, and I hope other states will follow what they're doing there in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
The Sawyer family also sued COCC for negligence and failure to protect its students. The Sawyer's attorney found the evidence we discussed at the beginning of the episode about Edwin's fascination with dead bodies and how he'd shown pornographic videos and images to his colleagues at work. But in a larger sphere, over the course of several years, COCC students and professors, as well as the Bend police chief, informed COCC administration that its security department had been operating outside its legal authority. For example, making traffic stops and arrests and investigating crimes without having the appropriate background checks and training required of actual police officers. Also concerning to the Bend police was that the COCC security officers had uniforms that were almost identical to those of the actual police, as well as being equipped with ballistic vests, pepper spray, body cams, and handcuffs. Now, COCC did do an internal safety audit, but changes were not put into practice very quickly, at least not until Kaylee's Law went live in 2019. A year later, in 2020, COCC settled with the Sawyer family for $2 million.
Okay.
As Kaylee's father stated after the lawsuit, no amount of money would bring the family peace, as it would never bring Kaylee back. And though Andrea is doing well now, she suffered immense emotional trauma for several years after her kidnapping, and I would suspect still does. Isabel Ponce's career in law enforcement was destroyed by her husband's choices, and her personal life was blown apart. The man Edwin shot at the motel in California had survived, but went through surgeries and physical and emotional trauma for simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. The ripple effect of Edwin's crimes were far-reaching, and we can only be thankful that he will never be on the streets again. If our listeners would like more information on the Kaylee Sawyer and Andrea Mays story, we invite you to check out the KGW8 podcast, Urge to Kill, by Ashley Corsline, which was essential in filling in so many of the details for our episode today. Before we go today, if you'd like to support Campus Killings, consider subscribing to the show with an Abjack Insider subscription through Apple Podcasts.
Your subscription will get you VIP access to all the shows on the network. That not only includes hundreds of episodes of ad-free listening, but also bonus content and early access to episodes.
For only $4.99 a month or $49.99 a year, you'll unlock a variety of listener benefits and you'll be supporting this show in the process.
Head over to Apple Podcasts and search for either Campus Killings or Abjack, and you can start your subscription with a free trial.
Your support is greatly appreciated.
Thank you, everyone, for listening today, and we hope you'll join us on the next episode of Campus Killings.
Campus Killings is hosted by Dr. Megan Sachs and Dr. Amy Schlossberg, with research and writing by Abigail Belcastro. It's produced by Mike Morford of Abjack Entertainment. Be sure to follow Campus Killings on social media. You can find Campus Killings on Twitter with the handle @CampusKillings or on Facebook at facebook.com/campuskillings. You can also visit the show's homepage at campuskillings.com. Be sure to tune in every other Saturday for new episodes of Campus Killings.